Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Susan Elder, and I work at Joint State Government Commission, which is a nonpartisan bicameral research office within the Pennsylvania Legislature. We're glad that you're able to join our podcast today for a discussion of current policy topics that impact the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm joined here today by our podcast team, which is Brian DeWalt, our co-host and audio engineer.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, Brian. And Glenn Passowitz, our executive director here at Joint State.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Glenn. And also Helen Kanjana, who's making her second showing on our podcast here. She is the project manager for the Diabetes Report.
Hello.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today here, Helen. Glenn, before we dive into the contents of this report, could you give us some background about this series of reports on diabetes?
Thank you, Susan. House Resolution 936 of 2013 envisioned that we would present an ongoing study of reports about Pennsylvania's Diabetes Action Plan and make recommendations on improvements. From what I understood at the time, it was common for most states to have diabetes action plans, and our initial work began with reviewing plans from other states. Shortly into the study, we learned that public health authorities, led by guidance from the federal level, shifted focus and funding to include a broader spectrum of public health programs that covered the major chronic diseases that are interconnected, those being diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and obesity, among others. There was and continues to be an evolving comprehensive array of programs dedicated to diabetes prevention and management that deliver services to patients as individuals and are designed to take into consideration each person's conditions. And this is what we've delivered through 5 iterations of the report. The significant addition to this edition is information about an additional health problem that has a highly damaging connection to diabetes, and that is COVID-19.
Thank you, Glenn. Helen, could you give us a little bit of an understanding of how COVID impacts people with diabetes?
It has become very clear that diabetes presents a major underlying condition that makes COVID consequences much more serious for people who get it. Even in the early stages of the COVID pandemic, doctors in China, in Italy, in Great Britain noticed that people with diabetes end up in the hospital more often, end up on ventilators more often, and unfortunately die much more commonly than people without diabetes. Some data that have become known to us now are really stunning. People with diabetes are 4 times as likely to die from COVID than people without it. They are more than 3 times or 4 times, according to different studies, likely to have severe outcomes of different kinds. I won't give you a lot of data in this brief podcast, but I would just give you one number showing the extent of it. In 2.5 months in Great Britain in spring 2020, 1/3 of all hospital deaths with COVID-19 was people with diabetes, which is certainly much, much higher than the rate of diabetes is in Great Britain, as you can imagine. Any other shocking data. By now, doctors are better aware of the mechanisms that may lead to such drastic consequences for people with diabetes. There's a variety of factors that explains why people with diabetes are in such jeopardy if they get COVID. There have also been unexpected and alarming signs that COVID may actually cause a new onset diabetes, that people not only have high blood sugar levels during the disease, but they are left with ongoing diabetes as a chronic condition after they had experienced COVID. This area needs a lot of further research and is being done, but both of the tendencies that I mentioned to you are certainly very alarming. People with diabetes need extra protection from catching COVID in the first place.
Helen, how does telehealth or technology impact this current situation?
Obviously, the pandemic made care providers in all areas to look for new ways of handling treatment. With diabetes in particular, it became obvious that there was a huge need in ways of treatment that would limit personal contact, including in hospital situations, and at the same time would make the care continuous, which is obviously critical in COVID. Telehealth and remote monitoring of the glucose blood levels became two of the areas where medical providers turned to. Televisits in general provided about 20% of all contact with doctors, and some of the remote devices turned out to be very useful. There's certainly a growing attention to telehealth in general. As far as diabetes is concerned, what people are focusing on is the ability to maintain continuity of treatment along with longer prescriptions for medications. But people should also be aware of limitations that telehealth can provide. So in particular, on the one hand, telehealth, including prevention programs, which are very important for dealing with diabetes, can be done by Zoom, as we are doing this podcast now, or by other means of remote communication. And for example, some programs provided by the Department of Aging found it very, very helpful. On the other hand, telehealth presents challenges, as does remote monitoring. And the main challenges, I would say, are privacy and technical preparedness. Privacy is an issue for all generations. Technical preparedness is more of an issue for the elderly, who are also more prone to having diabetes. Not all elderly patients have access to the computer. Many of them do not have the acumen to deal with the remote monitoring and even reporting their results. So these challenges need to be addressed if telehealth keep playing a major part in the future. I must say that some of the advances that were made during the pandemic may turn out to be helpful in diabetes care, not only in case of a national emergency, but also, say, for rural populations where highly qualified endocrinologists are not available in person and in some other areas.
Yeah, many of us were forced to help loved ones kind of navigate telehealth or things that they really weren't interested or open to doing before. So the pandemic has kind of pushed it into a newer era in that way. One of the things that the report pointed out is that a key to diabetes treatment can be this personalized approach and joint decision making. Can you give us a better understanding of what this means and how it impacts patient health?
This is really critical, Susan. No wonder the American Diabetes Association has made it in focus in its most recent couple of reports. The thing is that with conditions like diabetes, adherence of a patient to the plan of treatment is critical. You can devise the best program, but if a patient cannot or will not follow your instructions, it is not going to help. So when they're talking about personal approach and joint development of the course of treatment, they actually mean a variety of factors. One would be that instead of standard numbers, say, keep your A1C below this and that and so on, there should be variety dependent on the age of the person, especially with the elderly. You may have to balance the risks of hypoglycemia and the desirable level of A1C. Maybe you shouldn't strive too hard. But it also incorporates a variety of factors, including whether the patient can afford the medications you prescribe. If he can't, he won't be getting the required amount of insulin, let alone other matters. Is the person capable of understanding how he needs to monitor his sugar levels? If he has access to the device that is necessary, and if he is able to actually use this device, all these factors, including many economic factors and psychological factors, should be discussed with the patient at the beginning of the conversation. Nutrition, everything else, support network. The doctor should really try to incorporate all his factors into his plan. Then he'll be able either say to suggest a different medication or a different device, or help the patient, hopefully, to find a way to deal with these challenges and overcome them so that adherence to treatment could be achieved. I should say that a crucial factor is whether a patient has insurance at all or not. Because if a patient has no insurance, chances that he would be able to adhere to the treatment plan are really minor. Diabetes is an expensive disease. You know that even regular people with insurance have to spend about 2.5 times more than other people on their medical care. Without insurance, it's pretty much impossible. So increasing adequate coverage and actually making some changes to coverage that the report is also discussing is necessary for the patients to adhere with their individualized plan and to avoid later, more expensive, devastating consequences.
What recent developments have been attracting attention in the area of diabetes?
Thank you, Brian. This is certainly a question we are all interested in. Where is it all going? And there were some specific trends that raise concerns. One of them would be a vast number of pregnant women who are diagnosed with diabetes. Some of them probably had it before and it wasn't found out because women in their 20s and 30s are not normally tested for diabetes. And some of it is what is called gestational diabetes, which is something that is associated with the pregnancy itself. The number of cases of gestational diabetes has increased significantly, and it is a concerning trend because it affects both the mother's health and the child's health, not only then, but in the future as well. Another concerning trend would be growth of diabetes, in fact, both diabetes type 1 and type 2 in children and youth. And obviously, the early onset of diabetes will just, frankly, have more time to cause serious problems and complications just due to the length of life of the patient. So this is another trend that is drawing attention. And I must say that the general trends of diabetes numbers in the future are very, very concerning. The report reviews a couple of studies talking about the economic burden of diabetes and just the number of diabetes cases that are expected. You know that diabetes has been growing very fast. Between 1980 and 2014, according to CDC, there was nearly threefold increase in the cases of diabetes. And this tendency, unfortunately, is developing faster than expected. The numbers of cases of diabetes that were expected by 2025 have already been achieved by 2010. And looking into the future, what the researchers see is that the number and percent prevalence of diagnosed diabetes among the United States adults are projected to increase continually through 2060 by very, very significant numbers, reaching, they are expected to increase from 22.3 million in 2014 to almost 40 million in 2030, and then reach over 60 million in 2060. These are humongous numbers, as you can imagine. It's really huge. It's expected that about 40% of American population may have diabetes, which is certainly not where we want to go. To say something positive about it is that it is obvious that implementing effective prevention strategies to slow the increasing burden of type 2 diabetes is an urgent public health priority. According to analysts, if we are able to reduce the diabetes incidence rate by 20%, we would reduce the number of people with diabetes by 5 million in 2030 and 10 million in 2060. So obviously, all efforts should be made to somehow curb that huge growth that we are seeing by prevention and by taking effective steps in the early stages of treatment.
So, Helen, during the writing of the report and shortly after it was released, I'd gotten some emails from people who were familiar with diabetes. One person who was a nurse who had worked with diabetes patients, and she was looking for ways to become involved as an advocate for diabetes. So my question then is, do you have any recommendations for people who want to get involved with diabetes advocacy? You know, where's a good place to start?
There are quite a few advocacy organizations, and I'm sure the departments would also have some suggestions what to do. The first organization that comes to mind is the Diabetes Action Network. Its branches exist in various states. The one in Pennsylvania is very, very active. So getting in touch with them may be a good first step. There are also the Diabetes Patient Advocacy Coalition, the Diabetes Sisters, the GDRF, and the T1D exchange, if the person is interested in diabetes type 1. Programs are usually overseen and organized by the big Commonwealth departments, such as the Department of Health and the Department of Aging. Local offices of these organizations may be helpful in suggesting what you can do and how. If the person you were talking about, Glenn, is a nurse, she may probably get some additional qualification in diabetes education and make herself even more useful than she already is. I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities. I would say that just increasing awareness of diabetes will be helpful in itself, because that's what we need.
Thank you so much, Helen. Thank you for taking the time to join us today and talk about this important topic. If you're listening and you would like more information, either about Joint State or about this particular study on diabetes, or we actually have several other studies about diabetes, please check out our website. If you click on the publications tab on the left of our website, you can scroll down and find prior year reports. And you can find all of this at jsg.legis.state.pa.us. The music on our podcast today is provided by Joseph McDade. Thanks and have a good day.